You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of August, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello, good morning, and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Tyler Brûlé, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, after Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood were deposed from power, we ask how the latest developments from the region have affected Hamas in Gaza.
While the tide of the Arab revolutions initially proved fruitful for Hamas in Gaza, the region has changed, and now the movement is isolated and facing a deep existential crisis.
And with stories from South Africa, Tunisia, and Kenya, we'll set the day's agenda with James Schneider from Think Africa Press.
Plus, in a preview of this week's Entrepreneurs, we find out how empty commercial space is being used by the pop-up economy.
We both kind of swept up with the insane possibility that landlords would give us the keys to their empty buildings and we would let charities use them. And that was 3 years ago, and we've been doing it ever since.
And film critic Jason Solomons will join us with a preview of this year's Venice Film Festival.
So all that plus we'll review this morning's Brazilian front pages, and we may even play some music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
And as you heard, we are indeed here in Studio One on a somewhat foggy morning. It really feels like back to school. And my deskmate here, Phil, you're dressed very back to school.
Well,
today.
No, I'm
you're
dressed.
Very sort of preppy.
It's the best of both worlds. I've got a sweater.
And you're holding on. It is, that's why it's back to school, because you're always sort of holding on to summer with your shorts as well.
I think it'll warm up today.
It might very well do so in the studio. We should have the news, though, first with Paul Osborne.
Monocle 24 News. The United States says it's certain the Syrian regime has used chemical weapons. Vice President Joe Biden called it a heinous act for which the Assad regime must be held accountable. But the White House says any military response will be solely related to the use of toxic agents. And the British Prime Minister David Cameron insists there's no desire for any stronger intervention.
Any decision would have to be proportionate, would have to be legal, would have to be about specifically deterring the use of chemical weapons. But I've recalled Parliament so this issue can be properly debated, so the government can listen to views in Parliament. And yes, it is my intention to put forward a motion in Parliament so that members of Parliament will be able to vote.
UN inspectors on the ground in Damascus are due to return today to the scene of last week's alleged attack. Russia and China continue to speak out against military intervention in Syria's civil war. Scott Lucas, who's a professor of American studies at Birmingham University, says there's only one way regime change is possible.
If you're going to take out Assad, the way to take out Assad is by giving, you know, weapons, giving support to the insurgents on the ground who are fighting him. The Americans have refrained from doing so far. So it's not just a question of airstrikes, but are the Americans now going to join the Saudis and the Qataris and the Turks? And basically saying, look, we're going to back the insurgents, and to the point where Assad will fall. If they decide to make that decision, yes, he will go.
Meanwhile, the New York Times says it suspects a group that backs Syria's regime was behind what it's called a malicious attack on its website. For the second time this month, the paper's site stopped working on Tuesday night. It thinks the pro-Assad Syrian Electronic Army was to blame. Officials in New Zealand say that tests on milk products from the giant dairy firm Fonterra found no evidence of a bacteria that can cause botulism. The contamination scare saw the firm's products removed from shelves in China, the Middle East, and Southeast Asia. But government tests have concluded there was no danger to human health. At least 16 people have died in a series of bomb attacks across the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. 85 others were injured in the explosions, the latest in a wave of sectarian attacks in the city. A building collapse in India is believed to have killed 3 people and left dozens of others trapped. The 3-story building collapsed overnight in the city of Vadodara in Gujarat province. The residential complex was only built 12 years ago. Government inspectors have been sent to the scene. The teenage son of a high-profile general in China's army is facing trial charged with rape. Li Chanyi is one of 5 people accused of attacking a woman at a hotel in Beijing earlier this year. 2 years ago, he was sentenced to a year's detention for attacking a couple in the city in a road rage incident. The United States is to send an envoy to North Korea within days, seeking the release of an American missionary. Kenneth Bae was convicted of trying to overthrow the government in Pyongyang and sentenced to 15 years hard labor. His family say he's innocent and in poor health. The US wants him freed on humanitarian grounds. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. It is 5 minutes past the hour here in London. Paul will be back at the bottom of the hour for another check of your world headlines. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. To via Monocle, 26 Cheche.
From London.
London, Caracas.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. We kickstart the show with our agenda center, where let's make it agenda setter, where we pick a region and look at least three big stories of the day.
Today, our focus is on Africa, and we're joined in the studio by James Schneider. He's editor-in-chief of Think Africa Press. Welcome to the show, James. Let's begin in South Africa, shall we? That country being hurtled by a raft of protests and strikes.
Absolutely. South Africa has been struggling with a recurring wave of strikes for the last couple of years, and it's come to another head this week. More workers walking off, and yesterday it was announced that another 75,000 will join them. So that's about 330,000 workers who are going on strike. And this is in the context of South Africa having sluggish growth. It's nowhere near what it needs to reduce its really high levels of unemployment. And their currency, the rand, is falling quite dramatically. It's fallen about 20% in the year. It's now well under 10 to the dollar. And it's difficult to see how the rand could strengthen given, one, domestic inflation, which is at about 6%, but also with other BRICS economies, their currencies falling with the suggestion that American quantitative easing is going to be wrapped up. South Africa just doesn't have any of the firepower to strengthen its own currency.
And this isn't just sector specific, because of course we've seen, you know, so many flare ups in and around, of course, the resource sector in the country. But, you know, only last week we've, of course, had executives flying in from headquarters, you know, certainly on the automotive side as well. So is this a little bit unprecedented that it's really, you know, going from sector to sector as well?
No, I mean, South Africa has a strong labour movement, and strikes are not irregular there. But there are a lot of changes taking place at the moment within the trade union movement itself. One, there's more competition emerging sort of to the left of the main trade union bloc, which is allied to the ANC, COSATU. And also COSATU having its own internal ructions. Again, it's the more left-aligned unions like NUMSA and so on are trying to push for a more radical and more redistributive growth path for South Africa versus the National Union of Miners, who are more favourable to what the ANC is trying to go through. Coupled with this, the Secretary General of COSATU has recently been removed for a sexual scandal where he slept with a junior worker who then accused him of rape, and that's now been rescinded. And so there's this power struggle going on within the union movement, which might lead to further action, one, to cover that up, but also to us, there's increased competition within.
But I guess it is important to know that this is a regular time for strikes in South Africa. Yeah. This is a period where companies and labor unions are constantly, I guess, renegotiating their contracts.
Yeah.
South Africa's finance minister came out just yesterday saying, in response to the rand, which has dropped about 20%, this could potentially be good news for the country's exporters. And let's look at a country like Japan, where the yen has fallen with Abenomics. Their exports are really surging. Could this potentially be an opportunity then for South African exporters?
It could be. I mean, I think he's slightly putting a brave face on it because there's no other option. And so, as you say, he came out and he said, well, the rand was overvalued, so this is a good thing. This might help exports. It may do to an extent, but South Africa's problem is that it imports a lot of its high-end technical goods, which it needs to create things for export. So the kind of immediate benefit of having a weaker rand is perhaps less strong than it is in other currencies because it's so dependent on high-tech imports.
James, let's move south to north. Why don't we stop in Kenya? Talks going on there between Kenya and Somalia concerning refugees. And what's core to that discussion?
So following all of the difficulties that Somalia has had with conflict and also with drought, there are about 500,000 Somali refugees in Kenya. And Kenya really basically wants them out. And it's done forced repatriation from the cities to refugee camps. Kenya has hosted the Dadaab series of refugee camps, which is the largest in the world. There are about 400,000 people in them. And Kenya is really trying to work out how it can take them back to Somalia. And the Somali government is happy to engage with this because it adds to the whole narrative that Somalia is now stable, Somalia is doing well, and the government is doing well. This is kind of problematic for two reasons. One, the idea that Somalia is now this wonderful, stable place doesn't really hold up. Last week, Médecins Sans Frontières, after 20-odd years operating in the country, had to pull out because of attacks on its workers. And also, the refugees aren't being consulted in this in any way. And it's not as simple as they can just go back to where they were before. Lots of them come from the southern region of the country, lots of them, their land will not be there for them and so on. And it's kind of, it's slightly ironic that the talks are happening today and there's no refugee representation because this week refugees in Dadaab are voting for their own representatives to manage the camp and deal with any possible further future negotiations. So they're electing today about 1,000 representatives, whilst nobody from the refugees has been invited to the talks.
And I guess this is also very bad news for the criminal syndicate when we talk about human trafficking and cartels, mm-hmm. which use, you know, tens of thousands of these refugees in Kenya as a source for them.
Well, I mean, yes, and any population which is in a perilous legal position is going to be prey to gangsters and organized crime and people trafficking and so on. The refugees just being sent back to Somalia wouldn't necessarily solve that problem. Or, I mean, because you could go completely the other way and regularize their stay in Kenya. But what really needs to be done is thinking more long term. There's going to be a population movement, at least along Somalia's southern and Kenya's northeastern border. And there needs to be a more intelligent way of working out how people can cross between those two regions and how land disputes and so on are going to be managed.
And finally, why don't we just, before we go, wrap up at the top of the continent, and we'll head to Tunisia.
Tunisia is trying to avoid an Egyptian fate. It's trying to avoid the kind of mass violence that we've seen in Egypt. And the Tunisian government, which is led by, but not only by, Al-Nada, which is kind of equivalent Islamist party to the Muslim Brotherhood, have been making very nice noises to the secular opposition, saying that they will allow probably a non-partisan government to form. They're delaying plans to make illegal old regime figures, and they've taken now a hard line on the Salafists, which was one of the key complaints that the liberal and secular opposition were having to the government, was that they were insufficiently strong on the Salafists.
But the opposition parties have said they won't proceed unless one of the demands, which is that the prime minister resign from the government. Is that likely to happen?
Well, Al-Nada has basically said he's not going to resign, but they're happy for a different government to take forward the election process. And it's being managed at the moment. This is the interesting thing about Tunisia. It's being managed by the big trade union bloc, which is avoiding violence. And they've agreed on some of the basics, which is non-partisan government. How they get from where they are now to there is not entirely clear, but they've got such an incentive to do so, looking at what's going on in the rest of the region.
Excellent stuff, James. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. James Schneider, editor-in-chief of Think Africa Press, many thanks for coming on the show today.
And coming up after the break, after the fall of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, we review the health of the newly orphaned Hamas party in Gaza.
You've read the magazine, you've listened to the radio, and you've even made it to our new cafe. But now there's more, a lot more. Hitting bookshelves this September is Monocle's first book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living. It's a quiet manifesto for doing things well that runs from the macro to the micro. Over 400 pages of fresh editorial, great illustrations and stunning photography, we look at what makes a great city, how to build a home you'll always love, why it's good to have a Shibaken dog by your side and a cocktail from the Dragonfly Bar in your hand. The Monocle Guide to Better Living will be available in all good bookshops around the world, and you can also order it at monocle.com. Happy reading!
It is just 9:15. If you're listening in Brussels, 8:15 here in London. This is Modori House with me, Tyler Brulé. And Phil Honnell, just a few months ago, Hamas was watching its international legitimacy reach previously unimaginable levels. Branching out from the confines of the Gaza Strip, thanks to a sympathetic leadership in Cairo, Hamas was preparing to welcome Turkey's prime minister on an official visit. But what a difference a few months can make in the rapidly changing Middle East.
The militant movement which controls Gaza is now losing allies left and right, while Egypt's new military rulers are cracking down on Gaza's lucrative tunnel economy. So what does the future hold for Hamas, and how might their fortunes affect the delicate efforts of Palestinian reconciliation as well as the greater peace process with Israel? Well, joining us on the line to answer these questions are George Hale. He's the managing editor of the Palestinian media outlet Ma'an, whose offices Hamas have closed in Gaza, and Monocle's Jerusalem correspondent Joseph Dana. Joseph, I want to begin with you. A statement from Fatah just a couple of days ago. They're actually considering declaring Gaza a rebel province. Is this the end of Hamas as we know it?
Well, I don't think that this is the end of Hamas as we know it. Hamas as a movement is a very tenacious movement, and it will very much fight back. The situation that Hamas is facing right now is really a crisis of legitimacy. Just a couple of months ago, if you were to go to Gaza, you would see diplomats in the hotels from places like Malaysia and Indonesia. And now with the military coup in Egypt, that just doesn't exist. And Hamas has basically been cut off from that very important kind of diplomatic world. And Israel and the Fatah leadership in the West Bank are really jumping on that because they believe that Hamas has basically been neutralized and they might be able to exercise some real force against them in the Gaza Strip.
George, I want to turn to you and just focus a little bit on Ma'an and just, you know, obviously what happened with the closure of your offices and what that's meant for you as a media brand.
Sure. I mean, this is, you know, obviously it's disturbing development for Palestinian media. You know, Ma'an is a national news organization. It's basically the only one that's not affiliated with the government or any political faction. And to have half the country cut off from that, you know, the services that Ma'an provides is, you know, it's a significantly serious development.
And Joseph, one of the things that we mentioned, Tyler mentioned in that opening, was, of course, the tunnel economy and how that's been affected. There are some kind of rumblings, rumors that perhaps the presidential guard could be brought in to help regulate these tunnels and bring back some trade between the two parts. Is that likely to happen? And how devastating has the closures of these tunnels actually been for the economy there?
Well, the economy is really based around these tunnels, and the fact that these tunnels have gone from maybe hundreds operating before the military coup in Egypt to latest figures are about five operating means that Gaza can't get necessary building materials as well as other items. And so it could very well be that Hamas will bring in the Republican Guard, and that's a kind of example of how Hamas is running the Gaza Strip. They control the security services, and they're able to exercise a kind of monopoly on violence, which they've done in the past against Shiite groups, against Salafi groups. And as their stock continues to decline, we'll likely see them become increasingly violent. And I think that's the real fear on many Palestinian minds, both in Gaza and in the West Bank.
Just if you're seeing something of a vacuum, and you just mentioned, of course, you know, various missions being welcomed, the likes of the Malaysians, the Indonesians. I mean, obviously, you know, they're probably not being too meddlesome. But who, as an external player, do you think right now is really operating on the ground and thinks that they really have an opportunity for further influence?
I think this is the million-dollar question. I mean, a lot of people, at least in the Israeli media, are speculating that the Iranians are going to try and take advantage of the vacuum that's been created in Gaza. Before the takeover in Egypt back in July, Qatar was really demonstrating a very strong influence in Gaza. They pumped in about $500 million just this year alone in projects, and that has all been basically cut. There's a new Qatari foreign minister, Amir, who is now kind of repositioning, or at least he seems to be repositioning his foreign policy towards that of Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia does not like Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood. And so we're going to have to see how Hamas is going to try and fill that vacuum, basically in this downfall of cash, and whether or not the Iranians or even maybe the Syrians, however unlikely that could be, will try and exercise any sort of extended influence in the Gaza Strip.
And George, we know that you guys have been pressuring international journalism unions around the world really to try to restart talks to get your offices back open. Does that look like it's going to be happening anytime soon?
The Attorney General has claimed that the order is temporary, and these media groups have given on quite a bit of support, but we haven't seen any development towards reopening the office. And I was just checking around this morning, no one really seems to know if there's any imminent change. I don't know if we should expect that or not, frankly, at this point.
Just before we go to both of you and Joseph, I'll just start with you. On the note of coverage from the region, unstable. But what does it look like in terms of also the presence of other foreign media from Western outlets, but also outlets in the Middle East as well right now? Have you seen sort of a ramping down or ramping up right now?
Well, I would say regionally, there's definitely a ramping up. I can tell you from my perspective here in Jerusalem, there's clearly a heightened tension among journalists. There's a number of journalists being kind of parachuted in anticipation of a possible conflict in Syria. If the United States and Britain lead airstrikes, there's going to be basically a rush of journalists to northern Israel to cover it from this perspective. In Gaza, it's a little bit different. We see the media moving in and out almost in packs. Last week there was a slew of articles about Hamas from all of the major bureaus. And so we see them kind of operating and trying to cover the situation, which is probably the Hamas movement in Gaza is one of the most important stories that will have ramifications for the future. But other than that, I don't see anything that much out of the ordinary these days.
And George?
In terms of the coverage in Gaza?
Yes, correct.
So, I would agree with Joseph. I mean, certainly the Hamas story is being told. It's incredibly important, and it has ramifications for the entire region. I don't know. I'm not even allowed to go to Gaza anymore, and I can't really comment on the media situation there at this point, other than what we know, which is that they're certainly cracking down on anyone who disagrees with them or challenges them in any way.
Great. George Hale of Ma'an News Agency in Bethlehem, Joseph Dana, our man in Ramallah. Thanks very much for being with us.
After this very short break, we'll be in China to get the latest on the trial of Bo Xilai. Could a political comeback be back on the cards?
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, eu, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London,
this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé, and Phil Hahn. The time is just 8:24 here in London. It means it's 15:24 in Shanghai, which is where we head now for a check of the Asian front pages.
Emily Ford is our woman in Shanghai, and she's on the line now. Welcome to the show, Emily. Let's begin very briefly, though, on the trial of Bo Xilai. Some rumblings within the Communist Party that unless the sentence for Bo Xilai is extremely harsh, that he could potentially have a political comeback. Is that ringing true there?
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, Tyler. Well, I mean, I think, the trial took everybody here by surprise, including, it seems, the Chinese prosecutors. I don't think anyone expected quite how defiant Bouchelaar was going to be and some of the surprises he would pull out. And it's reinvigorated his support base here, it seems. And so there's definitely a sense, you know, China has a history of political comebacks. Deng Xiaoping was ousted under Chairman Mao and then came back to lead the country. And there seems to be talk here now that that could be replicated with Bouchelaar, that if he's not handed a very, very, you know, punitive long life sentence in prison or even execution, that he could one day make a political comeback of this kind.
Emily, how does this coverage play out domestically? If you turned on any of the major news channels, where does it sit in an evening news lineup? Are we talking about item one or is it, item five?
I think that trying to strike a balance, the state media, between giving the trial, substantial coverage, but it wasn't mainly the lead item last week. They were trying to contain it. The tone was very controlled. You know, the newsreaders and the anchors all had very similar lines on this. And now the coverage of the Bo trial, while we're waiting for the sentence, expected to be early September, is very much sort of editorial, saying that, you know, He deserves a very harsh sentence, and the prosecutors, shouldn't show any leniency in the case.
Hi, Emily. This is Phil Hahn here. Let's move on to another story which has grabbed your attention: the story of British fraud investigator Peter Humphrey. Do you want to tell us about that?
Oh, sure. So this is a very interesting case. Peter Humphrey is a British anti-fraud investigator who's been in China for 2 decades. He ran a consultancy in Shanghai that worked for a load of foreign multinationals, helping them to gather information in China. He was a very popular, well-known expert here, and he was detained on July the 10th. Nobody had seen him since then until yesterday, when he appeared on Chinese state television in an orange prison vest, apparently confessing to the crime of buying and selling information. And this has caused a very big stir here. It's the first time, we think, that a foreign national has been shown on Chinese state television in this way.
Let's maybe turn our gaze out to the sea. I was looking at the Nikkei last night, and there was a story, you know, yet again, you know, the Japanese are reporting, incursions into their territorial waters by the Chinese Coast Guard, could be the Chinese Navy as well. And this has also led to, a further deterioration in relations, of course, between Japan and China. Neither are set to meet at the upcoming G20 in Russia. And, again, I wonder how this plays out as well, when Japan sort of reports that these vessels are in their waters. Are the Chinese also, triumphantly reporting that they're off the Senkakus or Diu Islands?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, throughout the past year, China's repeatedly sailed ships through the waters in the East China Sea in a sort of deliberate show of provocation to Japan. I think you can say Japan, too, has made moves that it knows will provoke the Chinese by buying back three of the Diaoyu or Senkaku Islands from a Japanese businessman who owned them. And it looks now that, there's really no solution in sight, because the two countries are refusing to hold high-level talks at the G20 in St. Petersburg on September 5th and 6th. China is accusing Japan of empty talk and saying that there's no point in engaging in high-level political discussion, because Japan is not going to play ball. And I'd imagine that the Japanese media is pointing the finger at the Chinese and saying that, they're not going to come to a solution as well. And so it's really a sort of standoff here.
Emily, thanks very much for coming on the show. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Emily Ford in Shanghai, many thanks.
From London
to New York
to Hong Kong
to Shanghai
to Jakarta
to Moscow
to Los Angeles
to Beijing
to Yokohama to Amsterdam
to Cairo
to Karachi
to Bogota, all around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And you are indeed listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. In the next half hour of the program, film critic Jason Solomons will join us to preview the Venice Film Festival. Very good news because I'm heading there next week. Our entrepreneurs team will report on the potential for London's empty commercial space and will review the Latin American front pages.
But first, here is Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
The United States says it is certain the Syrian regime has used chemical weapons. Vice President Joe Biden called it a heinous act and said the Assad regime must be held accountable. But the White House has said that any military response will be solely related to the use of toxic agents. Russia and China continue to speak out against military intervention in the civil war in Syria. UN inspectors on the ground in Damascus are due to return within hours to the scene of last week's alleged attack. Officials in New Zealand say that tests on milk products from the giant dairy firm Fonterra have found no evidence of a bacteria that can cause botulism. The contamination scare saw the firm's products removed from shelves in China, the Middle East and Southeast Asia. The government tests say there was no danger to human health. In the latest sectarian attacks in the Iraqi capital Baghdad, at least 16 people have been killed. 85 others were injured in the explosions. Last month, more than 1,000 people were killed across Iraq. A building collapse in India is believed to have killed 3 people and left dozens more trapped. The 3-story building collapsed overnight in the city of Vadodara in Gujarat province. The residential building was only constructed 12 years ago. And the United States says it will send an envoy to North Korea this week to seek the release of an American missionary. Kenneth Bay was convicted of trying to overthrow the government in Pyongyang and sentenced to 15 years hard labor. His family say he's innocent of the charges against him and is in poor health. And the U.S. says he should be freed on humanitarian grounds. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. Paul will be back at 9 o'clock in the morning, London time, just under 30 minutes from now with another check of your world headlines. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Tyler Brulé. Now, commercial pop-ups can be a good way to test-run business ideas and have helped breathe life back into recession-hit city centres around the world. But what if you're starting a charity, social enterprise, or arts project where funds are tighter and visibility can be even harder to gain? Well, one idea that is slowly starting to gain traction globally is the Meanwhile You movement.
You are so perky this morning. You're so fast. I don't know if I can read that as fast as you.
Too
the next
fast?
Bit. Yeah.
Do you think so?
Yeah.
Why?
Anyway, it's all right. Okay. The aim is to turn empty commercial property into spaces where startup charities and social enterprises can work or run projects. It might be a pop-up or a place to run activities. But for some, it's just about providing an office space, something that many fledgling charities and social enterprises are unable to afford. One organization operating here in the UK to model this is Three Space, I can't read today, recently shortlisted for the FT City Urban Ingenuity Awards. The idea for the organization, which itself is a charity, came from two young London-based entrepreneurs, and reporter Katie Bilboa went to meet them at one of their London projects to find out more for this week's edition of The Entrepreneurs.
The story of Three Space started when I was actually working for KPMG as an accountant, and it wasn't particularly lighting a fire, and saw this opportunity.
Henry Mason is co-founder of ThreeSpace.
And I kind of put this crazy ad online through this website called Escape the City for people looking to leap out of their corporate jobs and do something a bit more interesting. And Andrew was one of the people who replied. So in the spirit of online dating, we had a lovely little meeting in Carluccio's cafe in Spitalfields Market. And we just really hit it off, and we both kind of swept up with the insane possibility that landlords would give us the keys to their empty buildings and we would let charities use them. And that was 3 years ago, and we've been doing it ever since.
We're now on the main stairwell. So we're coming down the sea, that's part of the sea that's on the river.
Co-founder Andrew, or Andrew Cribb, shows me around Audit House, an imposing red brick building nestled on London's embankment, overlooking the River Thames. Look out through the windows and you can see the Oxo Tower, the London Eye and the Houses of Parliament. It used to be a magistrate's court, but while the landlord waits for it to be redeveloped, Three Space have moved several charities and social enterprises in to make use of the building, a prime piece of real estate that would otherwise have been unoccupied.
Looking after the building.
Andrew was working as a town planner. But like Henry, he felt he wanted to break free of his industry and go it alone.
The frustration I had working for various governments was the time frames you're working in was like 5-year time frames. Whereas 3Space, you know, when we got together, it was, this is something we can deliver tomorrow, the next day, week, a month.
So the pair founded the charity, laid the groundwork, and when it was ready to go in the summer of 2010, they both took the plunge, waving goodbye to their 9-to-5s.
When we started, we'd have to literally reach out to the local council, ask them who they'd perhaps cut funding from, or, you know, which local organisations were struggling and could they put us in touch with any. You know, now as we've grown, we get a huge response from ex-users or, you know, people who we've dealt with, who, if we get a new property now, we put it out to our network and often people come to us, which is a nice position to be in.
The ostensible benefit for landlords, because of the nature of the organisations they're paired to, is a reduction in business rates, insurance and security costs, a financial incentive that was crucial to launching 3Space during the economic crisis. But as Henry explains, the benefits go far beyond this.
We had a circus school in this huge 20,000 square foot out of town retail unit that was run by JJB, and they'd moved out in a hurry, and so they still had the giant Nike tick on the wall and, you know, the Just Do It message. But going on in there, they were teaching kids trapeze and, you know, doing parkour and stuff. And I think, you know, for businesses, that's a great brand booster, you know, turning something that's a real liability to their brand into a positive. And I think also, you know, for communities.
It's this belief in adding value to towns and cities that's at the heart of 3Space.
For us, a healthy city is a diverse city and a city that has a lot of things happening. You know, it doesn't help anyone to have empty space. So we would love for the 3Space model to become established in the property world. We can unlock a huge amount of value. And I think, you know, if landlords start to understand that, then it doesn't become just a recessionary moment and it doesn't become just a charitable thing.
In this building alone, there's the Restart Project, who help teach people to repair their own electrical equipment at pop-up events, a podcasting organisation who advise charities on digital strategy, and Street Doctor, who teach first aid to young children at risk. Medical graduate Rebecca Long explains the benefit to them of being in this building.
Before now, we were just kind of, I guess, desk hopping at libraries and spaces such as that, or working from home. But it's been really helpful to have a space that can just be your workspace and a place where we can have meetings and have a more professional outlook to people who are looking to collaborate with us.
Just up on the next floor is the Good Gym, who couple volunteering activities with exercise in different locations around the city. Sean is their North London coordinator.
We're saving money, which we'd have to spend on rent, but also it's great to be kind of in and amongst other different organisations, so it's a great opportunity to sort of meet other like-minded people and people who are running some cool different projects in the area.
Andrew tells me that they're keen to scale the project.
I think if you look at in terms of how much empty property there is out there, the scale of the opportunity is massive, and there's 40,000 empty shops in the UK alone. You know, what we want to do is make it as easy as possible and scale what we're trying to do and take it to as many people and as many locations as possible.
And though it's not been easy convincing the slow-moving, established property industry to put their faith in a small, entrepreneurial startup charity, the success they've had so far has inspired them to keep going.
It's really nice, you know, when people come up and say, we were able to do a project that, you know, we weren't otherwise able to do. And I think even beyond that, when you hear people in the street who are walking past, and, you know, perhaps some of these units have been empty for years, you know, some of these buildings have been sitting there, and when they're like, you know, it's really nice to see that being used for something positive. One of the things we need to do over the next couple of years is to build a case for why actually it enhances the livability and enhances the desirability of a city to have some of these arts projects, some of these social enterprises, you know, that perhaps can't pay the commercial pop-up rent.
There's a true entrepreneurial spirit to this charity, and it strikes me that underpinning all of these benefits for landlords, charities and social enterprises is a belief that even in this digital age, a physical space and a physical presence is still what's essential for any type of organisation to succeed. And for these two young entrepreneurs, the hope is that meanwhile use will become an established part of the dialogue about the future of our cities. For Monocle in London, I'm Katie Bilboa.
And there'll be much more from the world of entrepreneurs, of course, on our program, The Entrepreneurs, of course, that premieres this evening.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Tyler Brulé. We'll be back right after this to head to Venice for the annual film festival.
From market to table, the history of Sicily can be interpreted through its rich cuisine. Monocle Films traces the island's past with a tasty visit to a hands-on cooking school.
It's not so much about the recipe, but it's exactly about an experience. My dream is to offer to the people who come here an experience of a style of life that starts from the soil and arrives to the table.
A Taste of Sicily in the film's menu on monocle.com.
In Istanbul, they took to the streets in a battle for green space. In Sao Paulo, they marched in their thousands in a fight for cheaper buses. In Athens, they shouted loud to demand a better run capital. That's why urbanism matters, why words like density, infrastructure, and smart cities need to be dragged out of city hall conclaves and turned into a public debate. And that's why every week, Monocle's show, The Urbanist, reports from cities around the world that are getting horribly wrong and deliciously right, visits the mavericks and mayors with a vision further than the edge of their desk, and asks the questions that will shape how we live tomorrow.
Who governs the city, who owns the city, who has a right to decide what happens in the city?
The bridge becomes an instrument not of moving traffic, but of land development.
There needs to be a voice for the people that says, okay, now we need a library, now we need the green park. These things that are greater than the individual interests.
Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:41 here in London. It's 9:41 in Venice, which is where we're heading over to next. Now, the city is celebrating an important milestone. Today marks the 70th anniversary of the Venice Film Festival. The world's oldest competition dedicated to the silver screen will be held along the sandy banks of Venice's Lido, an important site, especially this year after the reorganization of the venues.
Festival organizers abandoned plans for a multi-million euro cinema complex 2 years ago, and instead focused their attention and resources on a series of crucial updates of the Sala Grande, a cinema dating back to the 1930s. So, with a new lease on life, so to speak, on the festival, what can we expect for this year's competition? Well, joining us on the line now from Venice is film critic Jason Solomons. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. What's interesting is that Venice has a number of different pockets. You've got, of course, the Venezia 70, which is the main competition, and then so many other subcategories. For a veteran like yourself, what is the most interesting area of the festival?
Well, I think at the moment, as you say, Venice is updating itself and trying to kind of haul itself into the modern era of festivals. It is this one. It's celebrating its 70th, but how is it going to compete in what has now become a huge industry, the global film festival circuit, if you like? It's under such pressure from a festival like Toronto, which begins next week in North America, and has, if I'm honest, kind of snaffled away some of the bigger name titles, has become a bit more of a harbinger for Oscars. Venice is having to recalibrate. What can I do? Arm of the festival circuit that me and Cam, they kind of the Venezia 70 competition is probably the most important thing by which Venice lives and dies.
Jess, you're probably in a very thick-walled villa off the Grand Canal, and I'm wondering
if you could be on the gondola.
Could you maybe sort of throw open the shutters and maybe get closer to a window if possible?
I'm hoping, and Kel, I'm hoping that there'll be the buzz of the I'm by the canal, actually, so you could hopefully kind of hear me. I'm not in a palazzo, which is my usual residence. I've come down, obviously, from the summer to the Lido, and I'm hoping that you can hear that.
This has improved.
Jason, the film festival opens today with the Sandra Bullock thriller Gravity, but the list of films premiering at this year's festival are quite diverse. We have a film from Donald Rumsfeld, there's James Franco's new film, which is all about a man wanting to have sex with dead women. What are the standout films for yourself?
Well, that's right. I mean, everyone today is kind of a buzz with George Clooney giving his annual visit. He summers in Italy up at Lake Como and then kind of gently chugs down to the Lido. So it's a sort of another opening of Venice for him. He's in a film with Alfonso Cuarón, who's one of the great world cinema directors. He's been living in London for many years now, and it's been ages since he's made a film, and people are very anxious to see what this space age film Gravity is all about. And there are a number of kind of filmmakers here who haven't made films for a long time. Terry Gilliam, for example, is here with a film called The Zero Theorem, which has taken him almost sort of 15 years to get off the ground. And another British filmmaker called Jonathan Glazer, who really has got a great reputation, but is based really on only two films. He made Sexy Beast back in 2000, another film called Birth, which premiered here in Venice in 2003. And it's taken him years to get his third feature film, Under the Skin, off, and it stars Scarlett Johansson as an alien offing backpackers in Scotland, which sounds very strange and looks rather wonderful. So there are some big, big names whose reputations are hoping to be cemented by Venice in that sense. And it's a question of whether this festival can kind of wrest back a bit of a global reputation as a place to kind of premiere the big films. It's also, let's not forget, as Tyler knows too well, it's a conversation about art in Venice always. The Biennale is always ongoing. It's art, it's music, and film has to take its place amongst one of those, as the seventh art, as the French call it. So that's the difference that Venice 70 can make. It could kind of say that filmmaking is an art process rather than just a sort of commercial exercise in a run-up to the Oscars.
And is that where, you know, these, let's say, all these sub pockets come into it, like the Orizzonte, like Final Cut Venice, Jason, and to really sort of underpin and hopefully, of course, you know, foster future generations of directors as well?
Yes, that's right. I mean, Orizzonte, for example, is I suppose, where you get to see films that are bubbling under a slightly more experimental kind of strand to films. But I'm looking at it this year, maybe because they're undiscovered as yet. I haven't seen anything in there that is particularly exciting, but maybe that's where the discoveries are going to happen. And that's probably what it needs to do. It needs to kind of foster a whole kind of a tranche of new young filmmakers who want to debut their work here. But the problem is that there are so many other film festivals now where they go and do that. I mean, it's probably cheaper to go and do it at the London Film Festival, at Edinburgh, for example, if you're on the UK base, or even in places like San Sebastian or Sundance, for example, or Tribeca. So the competition has kind of grown against something like Orizzonte. So for true experimenter, you're probably not going to find it in Venice anymore. And that's a concern for this festival.
Well, absolutely. You mentioned a slew of other film festivals there around the world. Venice Film Festival this year turns 70. Do you think there's longevity in Venice?
Well, that goes for the city in general, doesn't it, really? You hope that the festival is not sinking along with the rest of its host city. I'm not sure. It is getting very, very expensive. Fewer and fewer people are coming this year. More and more people do like to go to Toronto, especially British filmmakers, for example, and British producers like to go en masse to Toronto and hope for those American distribution deals. We're not seeing business being done in Venice so much. So I'm concerned that it really has to kind of renegotiate its way. As Tyler mentioned in the intro, they were going to spend a lot of money on redesigning the theatres here, which have stood since the 1930s, and they put a chunk of money aside for a new project, then discovered that there was asbestos everywhere, that this was not feasible. They spent a lot of wasted money. It's been a huge scandal here in Italy, and now they've kind of got this kind of chipboard city, which is kind of, you know, for a place as venerable and ancient as Venice, looks a little bit, you know, B&Q, a little bit kind of put together. So the festival really needs to work out in the next 10 years what it's going to do with itself. Otherwise, I think Venezia 80 will be a rather drab occasion.
Jason Solomons in Venice. I look forward to bumping into you, maybe having an Aperol spritz with you next week. Jason Solomons there at the Venice Film Festival. You must be very excited, Phil, about a new Sandra Bullock film, because I know you were very excited about The Heat when it came out a couple of weeks ago.
The Heat. Oh, I was a big fan of Speed.
Okay.
And right. Speed 2.
Of course.
But this next one, it's called Gravity, and it's all, of course, set in space. Looks quite interesting. And 3D, are you a fan of 3D films?
No, I'm not a fan of 3D films. I'm not. Has 3D really worked? I mean, I know it's important. They say that, you know, U.S. companies cannot release a film in China unless it is in 3D. And I think that's sort of, you know, partly, you know, maybe a way of also blocking some U.S. films from going into China. No, I'm not. If I was invited around to your house, would I find some 3D glasses in front of your television?
Well, I do have a 3D television, but I've got to admit, I've never actually watched it in 3D. And I think that's a real problem for all these television manufacturers. Really hoped that 3D TVs would be the next big thing, but it really hasn't materialized, has it?
No. And unless, of course, you have a sort of a brood of rugrats, which we know that you don't have.
One day.
Hopefully, your family wishes. Anyway, time for a bit of a song. This is something originally from Belo Horizonte. They released their debut album earlier this year. Strong influence, of course, from the whole Tropicália movement. This is Desdenha by Graviola.
And that was Desdenha there by Graviola. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Tyler Brulé. It's time now for us to have a flick through this morning's Brazilian front pages. We're joined by Monocle researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Good morning, Fernando.
Good morning,
how are you?
Phil. Very good. Good morning, Tyler.
Good morning. Are your toes tapping under the table? Did you like that, Graviola?
Yeah. Oh, I like
it. It was your personal choice.
I like Graviola ice cream, actually.
Oh, what is that? Exactly?
It's like a little Brazilian fruit from the Amazon. It's not very easy to find, actually. It's quite an exotic fruit.
Can you find them in the Brazilian markets of London?
No.
No.
It's okay. Very difficult.
All right. Well, we'll leave that.
I'll bring some from Brazil to you.
Okay, we'll leave that for the menu, but don't get busted when you come through customs.
Yeah.
I wanted to start. You have a lead story, which, of course, is a foreign ministry piece. But I want to go to a second item in Globo, which is about that TAM, which has really become the default national carrier, of course, after Varig imploded. They got rid of 400 crew yesterday. And this is, you know, this is a typical cost-cutting measure that we've seen. But they've also reducing 12% of their flights there. And I think perhaps more significantly in, of course, the run up to the World Cup, that they are also canceling direct flights out of Paris, out of Frankfurt into Rio. So cost cutting. But I thought, can you give us a bit of a domestic spin on this? Is this because of the rise of low cost carriers? Why is TAM being so challenged?
I was very surprised, actually, to read that, Tyler, especially, you know, because Rio is going to be the host of the Olympics and they're cutting direct flights, you know, to major European cities. And I mean, I've read the article and I think the major reason, I mean, that they actually let TAM, they had a loss of $330 million in the second trimester this year. And the fact is that because the real, our currency, was very devalued, I think was one of the most devalued currencies this year so far. And I think that's probably one of the main reasons. And I do think Brazil, we need more competition in the aviation market, you know, because we don't have, we definitely don't have kind of cheap options to travel to Rio, for example. I mean, for example, I was there one day in São Paulo. I wanted to travel back to Rio, and it's so expensive, you know. So I do think Brazilian market needs more competition. And it's a shame that tennis.
Well, do you think they're going to be shifting their focus from the European markets to perhaps American markets? And I just say this because they're increasing, for example, seat capacity to Orlando by something like 55%. Do you think this is a business shift,
or probably more domestic as well between Latin American countries? I would say more than just to America. So, I think they probably do more connections to Argentina, to Chile, and to other Latin American countries.
Why don't we head up to Brazil? Let's go back to the lead story and everything that's happening at the Itamaraty Palace.
Well, it's a huge crisis, actually, at the moment. You know, because as we all know, diplomat Eduardo Saboia, he helped Bolivian opposition Senator Roger Molina to escape to Brazil. And that actually cost Antonio Patriota's job. And now we have a new foreign minister called Luiz Alberto Figueiredo. He used to represent Brazil at the UN. And actually, it's funny how this situation is evolving, you know. So, for example, yesterday, Saboia compared the situation of the Bolivian senator to the one that Dilma lived in the dictatorship. You know, she was tortured and everything. And Dilma replied saying that actually, I mean, he can't even make this comparison because it's like comparing hell to heaven. You know, Brazilian politicians like to use those kind of grand words. And he was also supposed to be the new Brazilian ambassador in Sweden. Not anymore. Dilma just canceled that.
How will this affect Dilma at the polls? Of course, she's going to be campaigning the elections next year. How will this impact her, do you think?
I don't think this will impact her very much. You know, actually, she's kind of increasing the polls at the moment. You know, she's not as bad as she was like during the protest back in June. And it's interesting to notice as well the relationship between Bolivia and Brazil, because Lula and Dilma, they were always very cozy with Evo Morales. Of course, they're both leftists, although Evo Morales is a little bit more radical. But I think just because of this ideology, I think Lula and Dilma would never do anything that would embarrass Bolivia. But actually, they did this to us somehow. And I remember there was a case in 2002 where our then foreign minister, Celso Laffer, he was in a plane in La Paz, and actually the plane was stopped because they suspected that actually the same senator, Roger Molina, was in the plane, and he wasn't. But that was quite embarrassing. Mm. So, and there's been other cases as well, especially with Petrobras, and, you know, the Evo Morales didn't want to allow them to do business there. You know, so there's been quite a lot of issues going on at the moment. And a lot of the commentariat in Brazil is kind of angry with that.
And speaking of stopping passengers, how busy is the foreign ministry still just with the whole David Miranda incident? Has this calmed down in the pages? I mean, certainly it seems to evaporate off the front pages we're looking at here today. But, you know, a little over a week on, how is it playing out?
I have to say, kind of evaporated in Brazilian press. From what I've been reading, I think the kind of the British papers are kind of focusing more on this story, which is funny because, you know, it was a Brazilian guy, you know, the Guardian journalist, he has a house in Rio as well. But we're not paying that much attention to that story, which I think is quite important.
And Fernando, another story. You obviously are in very good shape. Oh, you seem very fit and healthy, but it seems like many of your fellow countrymen are not.
They are. Actually, obesity is increasing in Brazil. At the moment, 51% of Brazilians are overweight and 17% are obese. And especially in Rio, actually, 53% of adults, they're overweight. So, you know, we have this image of Rio, perfect bodies, you know, but, well, not really.
Well, that's actually one of the lovely things, though, when you're along the beaches, though, is that you do see a sense of activity, and you might have sort of, you know, saggy grandfathers, etc. But, you know, but everybody is out, and they may not sort of, but, you know, I mean, maybe they should be out a little bit more, and they should be doing more than 20 minutes.
You don't need to be skinny, you know, to go to the beach, you know,
or your Speedos.
Exactly. On that note, we are going to say that thank you, Fernando. Great seeing you this morning. That also brings us to the end of today's program. Thanks to our producer, Ala John, looking very fine in his t-shirt. He's getting a bit toasty over in the studio there. Also, Marie-Sophie Schwarzer, who is, of course, our researcher today. And we have the ninja behind the controls today. We have Alex Swanell, looking very, very good.
Very samurai.
Looking very good in a top knot, I have to say.
Up next after the news is The Menu with Marcus Hippie. Sophie Grove and Emma Nelson will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for me, Phil Hahn.
And for me, Tyler Brulé. I'd like to take it up to the top of the hour, but I'm not going to do that. We'll leave it right there. News is coming up in 1 minute and 10 seconds. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.